Great Hunters, a sci-fi space opera, written by Gary Kaufman, read and produced by Andrew Kaufman. For more information about the author, book, or podcast, visit www.kaufmansci-fi.com. Greetings, folks. My name is Andrew Kaufman. I would first like to start off by saying welcome and thank you for listening to my podcast. It means a great deal to myself, and especially my father, who is the author of the book to come. It is a labor of love for the both of us. While this work is early on in my podcasting career, I believe that you will very much enjoy the story. If you have any comments or suggestions, please let me know. I'll leave the details in the show notes. Above all else, I hope you enjoy the story. For now, let's get on with the show. Chapter 1. Garden of Exiles. Mike had spent nearly 1,000 years at the Center for Exobiology. Academically, he had done well, and until now, he had mostly enjoyed the experience. But this assignment sucked. Professor Jurgen scheduled him to go at night. Everyone else would be going in the daytime. The assignment also required him to hike through the woods. The woods themselves weren't a problem. Mike was part tree, and he thought of trees as his distant relatives. But he had grown up in a city, and he had never been in the woods at night. As he began his trek, he discovered that the woods were very dark. In fact, very dark was an understatement. He could see nothing. He also discovered that the woods were surprisingly noisy. Leaves rustling, branches creaking, and animals calling for mates, squabbling over territory, and occasionally screeching in terror while some larger animal was eating them. Mike gripped his small flashlight in one tentacle and pointed it at the path. He did not want to lose his way. Getting lost meant spending the night in the woods and waiting for dawn to find his way out. More than once, he considered turning around and fleeing back to campus. But, like a good student, he kept walking. After an hour, the light from his flashlight glinted off the metal surface of a gate. He had arrived at the Garden of Exiles. Black letters on the gate read, "No trespassing." On either side of the gate, gray stone walls decorated with lichens and ferns curved away into the darkness. This place looked like an ancient ruin, and he was not eager to go inside. The forest made him nervous, and the garden only added to his apprehension. Mike was not prone to outbursts, but now, standing in the dark, scared and a little angry, he asked out loud,
"Professor Jurgen, how will looking at vegetables make me a better exobiologist?"
Of course, Professor Jurgen wasn't there to hear his question, and Mike would never have had the nerve to confront him in person. But the sound of his voice startled a small animal, and it scurried noisily away through the dry leaves. In turn, that noise scared Mike. He cried, "Ah!" and all 8 of his tentacles straightened in surprise. He lost his grip on the flashlight, and it tumbled to the ground. He quickly picked it up, thankful it was still working.
"How embarrassing," he thought, "scared witless by a little animal. We exobiologists are supposed to be brave."
Mike took a deep breath and refocused on the assignment. He had found his way here. What remained was a quick walk through the garden, followed by an even quicker walk back home.
"You can do this," he said to himself.
Using the tips of 2 tentacles, he opened a pouch strapped to his trunk and removed an old-fashioned brass key. He inserted the key into the door's keyhole and turned it clockwise. Inside the door, levers moved, and Mike heard a metallic click. Metal locks and keys like this hadn't been used for 100,000 years. The garden was ancient, and Mike wondered if this might be the original lock. Weeds had grown up inside the gate, and Mike had to push hard to open the gate enough to squeeze through. Once inside, he used his light to look around. It wasn't a garden in the usual sense. Weeds and tall grasses covered most of the ground. At the center of the garden, he saw eight figures. These eight had once been exobiologists who traveled in space and explored other planets. Now they stood motionless, their trunks covered by shaggy moss, their stiff tentacles stretched out like the branches of trees. They had broken the no-contact rule. And, as punishment, the faculty of the Center for Exobiology had planted them in the Garden of Exiles. Erdiu is a civilized planet with very little crime. If one of Mike's species, the Eldman, breaks a rule, a judge might levy a fine.
Only for the most severe of crimes would someone get planted.
When the authorities plant an Eldman, they dig a 1 meter hole. Then they lower the guilty party into the hole, roots first, and pack dirt back into the hole. The average Eldman is 3 meters tall, so planting is not like being buried alive. In everyday life, an Eldman's stubby roots easily detach from the ground and act as short legs and feet. Now this gives them mobility. However, a planted Eldman is trapped. Their tentacles are poor tools for digging in dirt, and they lack the strength to push an Eldman's trunk out of a meter of soil. Planting may seem like a mild punishment for a serious crime, but it is only the start. Shortly after being planted, the Eldman's roots regress to their ancestral form and spread through the soil like the roots of normal trees. This permanently anchors the Eldman in place. Then, after a few months, or perhaps as long as a few years, a second regression begins. The interconnected bacteria that make up an Eldman's brain and nervous system start to disconnect from each other. As the disconnections continue, the Eldman suffers paralysis and increasingly severe dementia. Ultimately, he or she becomes what is disrespectfully called a vegetable. With his eyes focused on the ground, Mike walked past the first three figures. The Center for Exobiology required all upper-level students to make a trip to the garden, and even though he hated it, Mike understood the reason. The one unbreakable rule for an exobiologist is the no-contact rule. It meant that exobiologists may not contact or influence the sentient beings on another planet. At some time in the past, these eight figures had broken the rule, and now they stood as mute reminders of the consequences. As Mike passed the fourth figure, a husky voice called,
"Hey, Mike!"
For the second time that night, all eight of Mike's tentacles straightened in surprise. This time, however, he managed to hold on to his flashlight. The fourth vegetable had called him by name. In a barely audible voice, Mike replied, "Yes?" He could see the fourth vegetable's eyes. They were open and sparkled in the light from his flashlight. The voice asked,
"Got time to talk?"
Fear hormones had flooded Mike's body, preparing him to run. But after the initial panic, the rational part of his mind regained some control. This wasn't life-threatening. It was only very, very strange. He managed a weak reply.
"Yes, sir."
The husky voice continued.
"As you might imagine, it's lonely as hell here. I can't even talk to the other guys. They've been silent since before I was planted."
Struggling to make sense of what was happening, he asked,
"How'd you know my name?"
"It's printed on the bag you're carrying."
Feeling foolish, Mike said,
"Oh.
So tell me about yourself, kid. You're a student, right?"
"Yes, sir. Almost done. Supposed to graduate in 52 years.
"Ah, that's great. I remember that feeling. I was so proud. Sure I knew everything."
This ordinary conversation and this vegetable's friendly tone eased Mike's fear. Besides, he thought of himself as an explorer, or at least an apprentice explorer. And this was unknown territory, because vegetables didn't talk. Mike asked,
"When'd you graduate?"
"Class of
100,436. After some quick mental calculations, Mike said,
"That was almost 60,000 years ago. How long have you been in here?"
3,412 years.
Mike was astonished.
"You can still talk."
Sometimes things don't happen like they're supposed to. My bacteria refused to break their connections. Well, a few connections broke. I can't calculate orbits in my head like I used to, but most of those little bugs are still connected.
"What's your name?"
Mike asked. "Everyone calls me Garwig, but my full name is Garofalo, second son of Darganza and Piccola of Mosenstrike."
"Mosenstrike? That's my hometown."
"You're kidding me. What's your full name?"
"Micropolis, first son of Baquan and Garbanol of Mosenstrike."
I remember a man named Garbanol. Nice guy. Could have been your grandfather."
Mike hesitated. He wanted to ask Garwig why he had been planted, but he thought that might be rude. Guessing what was behind Mike's silence, Garwig said,
"Go ahead and ask. I don't mind."
"Why are you here?"
"I broke the no-contact rule."
"What'd you do?"
"I was on my third assignment, observing the fourth planet of M087, and it was a sad situation. Dominant species had great potential, but the virus kept killing half the population. After the pandemic ran its course, the virus would appear to go away. Then, a century or two later, a mutated version of the virus would appear, causing a new pandemic. Every time they put their civilization back together, bam, a novel version of the virus would knock them back down."
"Did you help them?"
"Well, for thousands of years I resisted. But then the work of one of their scientists caught my eye. Incidentally, Mike, taking a personal interest in the natives is always a mistake. She was a brilliant virologist, but her understanding of spike proteins wasn't quite right. Time after time, her efforts came up short. Watching this was painful. I understood the problem and what she needed to do to solve it.
Finally, I couldn't resist. I hacked their electronic message system and sent her an anonymous note."
"Did it work?"
"Within months, she developed an effective vaccine."
"What happened then?"
"Vaccine worked, but there were other problems. The species had a high rate of reproduction. It was necessary to replace the population lost during the pandemics. The vaccine ended them, but they kept reproducing like crazy."
"Overpopulation?"
Mike asked. "Oh, yeah. Followed by famine, disease, and global economic depression."
Garwig closed his eyes.
"In the next century, more died from overpopulation than died in the previous pandemic."
Mike said, "They teach us about unintended consequences. That's why we have the no-contact rule."
"I know."
Garwig quoted from the no-contact rule.
"Planets are complex systems, and no one can foresee what's going to happen."
His eyes flashed angrily.
"If you want my opinion, that's a load of crap."
"But you saw what happened."
"That's not the end of the story. They got their reproduction under control, and in another 200 years, they were doing better than ever. They even started to explore space."
Mike's professors had taught him that interference always produced bad results. Sometimes catastrophically bad results. But now that he thought about it, that didn't seem quite right. Why would interference always produce a bad outcome? At least some of the time, interference should help, or at least not be harmful. Garwig had violated the no-contact rule, but he did so for a good reason. His interference had indirectly cost millions of lives. However, in the long run, assuming Garwig was telling the truth, it saved many more lives. In fact, Garwig may have saved an entire civilization. Until now, Mike had not questioned the ethics of his profession. The no-contact rule was sacred. But the faculty at the Center for Exobiology cared nothing about the results of Garwig's interference. It didn't matter to them whether the outcome was good or bad. Exobiologists observe and document. They don't meddle with life on other planets. Mike wondered if any of the other vegetables in the garden had done something for the ultimate benefit of a planet, and, like Garwig, they also got planted. Mike asked, "How'd you get caught?"
"My mentor read my reports and asked about the sudden end of the pandemic. I told him it was a scientific breakthrough. I didn't know that my ship's computer retained copies of all transmissions. He found my message to the scientist, and I was in trouble."
"Doesn't seem right," Mike said.
"I did what I thought was right. The faculty did what they thought was right. Unfortunately, they have the final say."
Mike's system of values, so solid just a few minutes earlier, now felt shaky. Had he uncritically bought into the no-contact rule? Could saving the civilization justify interference? Or was Garwig lying to make himself look good? Mike was silent. Garwig wondered what was going on, and said,
"That was pretty heavy stuff for a first conversation. You okay?"
"Yeah, but it's a lot to think about."
"Sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. All I do is stand here and think. Hell, I'm ready to talk all night."
"Well, can't stay that long. Got an early class tomorrow."
"I understand," said Garwig. "Thanks for stopping to talk to an old vegetable. You don't know how much I appreciate it."
Garwig had opened a door in Mike's mind, and what was behind that door both disturbed and attracted him. "Would it be okay," he asked, "if I come back another day?"
"I'm not going anywhere. My schedule is wide open."
Mike laughed. "I'll be back before the year's over." Mike was true to his word, and at least once a year, he walked back to the garden to talk with Garwig. Mike didn't make friends easily, but over time, he decided that Garwig's story was true, and he thought of Garwig as his best friend. When he visited, Mike summarized the past year's news on Erdiu. In return, Garwig told Mike what it was like to be an exobiologist. Not the theoretical stuff, which Mike already knew, but the practical details of observing and keeping his ship running. When Mike was discouraged about school, Garwig told him that he was going to be a great exobiologist. When Garwig was depressed, Mike told him how much he valued their time together. A month before he was to graduate and receive his first assignment, Mike made a last trip to see Garwig. Exobiologists' assignments are lengthy, sometimes lasting as much as 30,000 years. By the time he returned, Garwig would surely be just another vegetable. As he walked along the now familiar path, he tried to think of what to say. But nothing seemed right. What do you say to someone whose mind is going to disintegrate? By the time he reached the garden, he still didn't know. Nevertheless, this was a visit he had to make. Mike unlocked the gate and called out Garwig's name. But there was no answer. He hurried up to his friend, but found only another moss-covered tree stump. Garwig's bright eyes were closed. The disconnections had finally caught up with him. Mike knew this would happen, but it still hurt. He wrapped two tentacles around Garwig's trunk, hugged him, and whispered, "Goodbye." Tears blurring his vision, Mike left the Garden of Exiles for the last time, and slowly walked down the path back to the Center for Exobiology.
Well, everyone, that was episode 1. So, what did you think of Mike, Garwig, and what we've seen so far of their race? It is, at least to me, a very unique society and race of beings who seem to value gaining knowledge in the least impactful way possible, with a distinct parallel to the Star Trek universe's prime directive. You gotta wonder what the Eldmen would do if they studied a race that had similar levels of development and tech to their own. Would they contact them? Would they leave them be, like most other races they've encountered?
It should make for some good reading coming up. Speaking of coming up, certainly sometime after this first episode, probably more like after the second or third, I'm going to be putting a survey on my performance Facebook page asking if you would like to see this book in print or ebook format at some point in the future. Maybe even an audiobook. Once I figure out how to do it, I'll also have the survey up on Podchaser for those who would like to go that route. A few notes on the production itself. I'm using Audacity for making all of my edits and recordings, and probably will be for the foreseeable future. It's a pretty good program, and has served me well so far. My microphone is a Blue Yeti, and I know that some folks out there, especially gamers, do have an aversion, but the sound quality seems good to my ears, and if you set it up properly, it does a pretty good job. If you have any suggestions, I'd be happy to hear them. Also, the length of the episodes will be about 30 or so minutes long, depending on how many chapters and plot points I can fit into a 20 to 25 minute slot, plus or minus a few minutes, with a little time before and after for chat, babble, and answering a few questions. Well, I'm going to sign off for now. I hope you come back for episode 2. Until then, farewell. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the show, you have many ways to do so. You can send your feedback in text or audio to thegreathuntersnovel@gmail.com, and I'll be happy to read them for the credits. You can also submit it on the website, www.kaufmansci-fi.com. The Facebook page for the podcast and myself is www.facebook.com/performer.andrew.kaufman. If you like the book, please leave a review at Apple Podcasts and or podchaser.com. It really helps people find the show. That's all for now. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode. The book is copyrighted 2024 by Gary Kaufman. The intro song is Jet Fueled Vixen by Kevin MacLeod from incompetech.com and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 license. The outro song is Stay the Course, also by Kevin MacLeod from incompetech.com and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution 4.0 license. The contents of this podcast are copyrighted 2024 by Andrew Kaufman and is released on a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. So don't change it or sell it, but you can share it all you want. For more information about these licenses, please visit creativecommons.org.